Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be introducing this episode. But first, let me remind you of Sunstone's Ugly Sweater Fundraiser. So if you head over to sunstone.org, you'll see our collection of sweater designs from our very own Grace Poole that will elicit an appropriate amount of laughter from both your Mo and ex-Mo friends. So that means more than general conference joke laughter and less laughter than will get you in trouble with Doctrine and Covenants 8869. And yes, we've tested it scientifically. Anyway, these sweaters are perfect for all of your upcoming holiday parties, and we've added ugly t-shirts to the fundraiser as well, just in case you're the type who doesn't get cold during the winter. And why is it a fundraiser? It's because you're allowed, encouraged even, to pay way more than the actual price of the sweater. You can enter in the amount you want to pay over the sweater's price, and it will be counted as a donation to Sunstone with all the blessings and tax deductions thereunto appertaining. And you'll get a warm feeling, knowing that you're helping Sunstone continue in its mission to make the world a kind of place where there is more than one way to Mormon. If you enjoy our podcasts, if you enjoy the magazine, if you enjoy our symposia, this is the best way to make sure that they can continue on in 2024. Thanks for your support. So, I grew up in Utah Valley, surrounded by the Wasatch Mountains, and built into the side of one of the South Mountains was a white building that gave off a vaguely temple-ish feeling to me. And eventually, I heard that it was called the Dream Mine, which made it even more intriguing because, you know, what in the world do you find in a dream mine? Well, many years later, Kevin Cantera sent me an article that answered all my questions, and it turned out that my sense of intrigue was well-founded. The mine was started by a man who, for some, is the greatest prophet since Joseph Smith. The article is titled, Fully Invested, Taking Stock in Utah County's Dream Mine. Introduction, The Community of Believers. On the 14th of May, 2007, a crowd assembled in the convention hall of the Veterans Memorial Building in Spanish Fork, Utah, for the Relief Mine Company's annual stockholders meeting. An almost festive air preceded the official meeting as about 100 investors gathered to hear the company's annual financial report about the 113-year-old mining venture. Chatter and laughter filled the hall. Conversations sprang up where they left off at last year's meeting. The majority of stockholders were older people from the surrounding area in southern Utah County, where the relief mine is located. A few came from further away, some from Salt Lake City, about 50 miles to the north, others from neighboring Idaho. Nearly all were members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Many brought children and grandchildren, some of whom played tag between the rows of chairs. Since becoming available in 1909, Relief Mine stock has been something of a family heirloom, passed down from one generation to the next, and the meeting had a distinct family feel. One family had a table of books for sale, including an eschatological history of the Relief Mine. A husband and wife team moved about the crowd, striking up friendly conversation and handing out brochures describing various end-time prophecies and their imminent fulfillment. Sunburned, in well-worn jeans and dusty work boots, two old friends reclined in folding chairs and swapped prophecies about the last days. Despite the cheerful air preceding it, the official meeting was short and solemn. Company Secretary Ray Coyle, a great-grandson of the man who founded the mine in 1894, conducted the day's business. The process took only a few minutes because the Relief Mine Company, known locally as the Dream Mine, does little business. In fact, the company has done no actual mining for more than four decades. It has few operating expenses and brings in only a scant income. According to Coyle's review of the balance sheet and profit and loss statement, the total fixed assets of the Relief Mine Company were just over $3.5 million for 2006. Total net income for the year was about $41,000, coming largely from rents collected on property and revenue from a small gravel pit the business operates. After this quick accounting, Ray Coyle called for the assembly to pray and, on adjournment, asked those, quote, gathered here to take note of their feelings about this project. Let's focus on next year and wait, unquote. Waiting is something that DreamMind stockholders have practiced repeatedly. In the nearly 100 years since the operation went public, shareholders have never received a dividend. The mine has never produced a significant profit. The Dream Miners have never unearthed a single ounce of valuable ore. Nevertheless, stockholders remain committed. At present, at least 706 people own stock in the Relief Mine Company, and investors seeking to purchase a stake in the mine happily place their names on a waiting list for the chance to pay $30 to $35 for a single share. Shares with a real value, by the most generous accounting, of less than $10 each. Stockholders willing to talk about the mine typically discuss their unrealized investment with a sense of awe and reverence, often expressing the strong tie they feel to their stake in the company. L. DeLynn Doc Hansen, a Utah County native, bought his first piece of the Relief Mine, 100 shares, in 1980. For $3 a share. Quote, I was new in practice, and we were poor, Hansen, a chiropractor, remembers. I just pulled out $300 and said, here you go. My wife didn't even question it. Our last $300 to our name. She didn't even question it. Unquote. Why, despite the lack of any measurable success, does Relief Mine stock remain an object of desire? Beyond any material value, what does the mine reveal about Mormon belief? How has its meaning changed over time? For Dream Mine believers, the mine's true pot of gold exists not in a material world, but in a world yet to come. Excavating Belief, Faith, Function, and the Dream Mine. On a warm September day in 1894, John Hiram Coyle drove a pick into the rocky soil of a cone-shaped mountain, overlooking a wide swath of farmland along the southeastern shore of Utah Lake. He knew exactly where to dig. A Mormon bishop, Coyle claimed that he had received a nighttime visitation from the angel Moroni, the same heavenly messenger who had visited Joseph Smith decades earlier in New York State, leading the boy to unearth a set of ancient gold plates that later became the Book of Mormon. Coyle said that Moroni had actually raised him into the air and brought him inside a mountain through more than 1,000 feet of solid rock until they came to a formation of thick white quartz bearing an unmistakable vein of gold so accessible that it looked, quote, like a fish ready for the frying pan, unquote. A week after the vision, Coyle and a small band of Utah County Mormons began digging into the mountain in earnest, dubbing their excavation the Dream Mine. Coyle left no written account of his life and claimed that he had been divinely instructed, quote, never to make a written statement, unquote, about the mine. So the most important sources for studying the history of the Dream Mine come from two of Coyle's most ardent followers, Norman Pierce and Ogden Kraut. In his self-published chronicle of the Dream Mine, Kraut voiced the belief of many stockholders when he declared, quote, John H. Coyle was a man of simple faith and education, but he had a gift from God. His prophecies were not given for entertainment or curiosity. They were meant to convey a message of warning, unquote. As chroniclers, Pierce and Kraut reconstructed the history of the mine and its founder to echo important narratives from their Mormon faith. They crafted Coyle's history to mirror that of Mormon founder Joseph Smith. Pierce began compiling notes in 1934 for what would become the Dream Mine story, a narrative he constructed from stories, quote, repeated again and again by leading stockholders with some variations, unquote. Pierce freely admitted that, quote, it wasn't always easy to pin down the true and correct version every time, unquote. But nonetheless, he fashioned a story designed to mirror the founding miracles of Mormonism, and thereby engender belief in Coyle's mine. Kraut knew the mine's founder only briefly, and based his retelling of the story on Pierce's book and tales related by fellow believers. John Hiram Coyle was the son of two Mormon pioneers, John Hiram Coyle Sr. and Adlinda Hillman. Born in Nauvoo, the two made the trek westward to Utah as children, growing up in the Mormon colony of Spanish Fork. John, the couple's second child, was born on the 14th of August, 1864. Within 4 years of that birth, LDS Church President Brigham Young called Coyle's family to go to the so-called Muddy Mission, nearly 400 miles away in southern Utah, where church authorities hoped to establish a cotton colony. Life on the Muddy River was hard, and no doubt the early years of Coyle's life saw many hardships, as agricultural failures and near starvation plagued the venture. LDS authorities in Salt Lake City eventually abandoned their plan for the Muddy Mission and allowed the colonists to return home. The Coyle family moved back to Spanish Fork in 1871 with little to show for their efforts. John Coyle developed a reputation as a pious boy, who often reminded his elders of their duties to the Mormon faith. By age 14, he had abandoned formal education and was making his living as a mule skinner, traveling throughout southern Utah County by mule and cart, selling various goods to farmers. In 1884, the year he turned 20, Coyle married Emily Arvilla Holt. The newlyweds moved onto a farm in the lush river bottoms south of Spanish Fork, in a tiny settlement then known as Riverside and later called Leyland. Though raised in a devout LDS household, and despite his reported faithfulness, Coyle couldn't testify to a, quote, burning in the bosom, unquote, about the truth of the Book of Mormon and LDS theology. In accordance with Mormon belief, and in search of a deeper faith, the young man began to pray earnestly. He withdrew to a small grove of willow trees near the Spanish Fork River, dropped to his knees, and beseeched the Lord for the worthiness to receive, through the Holy Ghost, an unwavering testimony of faith. But when he ended his prayer, he, quote, noticed nothing different than when he had begun to pray. No answer seemed imminent, nor was any further testimony obtained, unquote. But later, God did answer him. That night, in a dream Pierce writes about, Coyle saw a red heifer that he had lost about 3 weeks earlier. In the dream, Coyle saw the heifer clearly, standing in a place he recognized, a far-off field below the Union Pacific Railroad tracks. The cow faced east, its right horn broken so that the point stuck in the creature's eye. Coyle heard a voice ask him, quote, "If you find your cow at this place tomorrow, will you believe that the restored gospel is true?" And unhesitatingly, John heard him say, "Yes, sir," unquote. The next morning, Coyle rode out to the field below the railroad tracks, and as he had seen in his dream, there stood his red heifer, with its broken horn, looking at him, contentedly munching its cud. Coyle could now claim his testimony. He was now convinced not only that the LDS gospel was true, but also that God worked through his dreams. Ogden Kraut concludes, quote, "From such a simple but marvelous beginning, John H. Coyle received a special spiritual gift. He also made a covenant with the Lord that if he would give him such dreams and visions, he would serve the Lord all the days of his life," unquote. Coyle's followers frequently measured their prophet against the founder of Mormonism. Norman Pierce unhesitatingly compared Coyle with Joseph Smith and believed that both had been called to, quote, "establish the church for the millennium," unquote. Ogden Kraut described Coyle as a, quote, "man who knew and talked with Joseph Smith the prophet," unquote. Such ideas persist today among believers such as Fred Nasbitt, a stockholder from Ogden, Utah, some 80 miles north of the Dream Mine site, who declares fervently, quote, "Coyle is second only to Joseph Smith in the number and accuracy of his prophecies," unquote. Buried treasure, Moroni and the founding of the Dream Mine. A few years after the dream that confirmed his Mormon faith, Coyle served an LDS mission to the American South. We know very little about Coyle's success as a missionary. he kept no diary, and the available sources make no mention of the converts he won. But a handful of mission field legends help establish Coyle's reputation as a visionary, including a story in which Coyle saved the life of J. Golden Kimball, a future general authority. For Dream Mind believers, the story offers further evidence that Coyle was among God's anointed and a vessel of divine purpose. In 1894, his mission service complete, Coyle returned to Utah. That same year, he reported his first revelation about the mine. On the night of the 27th of August, 1894, he received a visitation from a, quote, exalted personage from another world, who was attired in white and radiated intelligence, unquote, and who Coyle claimed was the angel Moroni. Moroni rousted Coyle from his bed and led him into the chilly night and across a few miles of farmland to a mountain east of his home. With, quote, an eerie sort of corporeal disintegration, unquote, they passed directly into the mountain, where Moroni showed Coyle a rich vein of gold within the mountain, which, quote, would be the means of bringing much-needed relief to the Lord's people, unquote. The angel led him another 175 feet down to a cluster of 9 enormous caverns hollowed into the heart of the mountain. Supported by massive pillars, the caverns contained uncounted piles of gold coins, minted and buried by a group of Nephites. Dream miners believe that the Nephites buried a number of other precious items within the mountain caverns, including the Sword of Laban, the Urim and Thummim, and the gold plates themselves. Because a large portion of the ancient record remained sealed by God and was never translated, dream miners believe that when they finally cut through the quartz and reach the treasure-filled cavern, they will be able to reveal the full dimension of the LDS gospel. The angel Moroni told Coyle that God had chosen him to open the mine under the mountain, but he also warned Coyle that the gold would not come in and the Nephite treasure would remain buried until just before the second coming of Jesus Christ, when wars, natural disasters, and the collapse of the American economy would create widespread suffering. Dream mine gold would not only provide relief, but also finance the gathering of Israel. 1 week following Moroni's visit, Coyle and a small group of believing neighbors began digging. Sharing the dream. Coyle goes public. For a few years after Moroni's visit, Coyle's project remained little more than a hole in the slope of the cone-shaped mountain. With a crew of volunteers, mostly neighbors who believed in his prophetic abilities, the excavation progressed slowly. Still, as word progressed that the visionary Bishop Coyle had begun his treasure quest, people joined the movement, volunteering their time and labor to be part of a project of holy possibilities. When Coyle incorporated the Coyle Mining Company in March 1909, a decade after digging began, shares sold swiftly. The original stock issue totaled 114,000 shares, of which all but 42,000 went to Coyle and 5 other company officers. According to Norman Pierce, most stockholders, quote, represented the credulous but thrifty poor among the Mormons, who desired to help others and be an instrument of great good among his fellow men during a time of great distress, unquote. The mine eventually drew the attention of LDS Church authorities, who worried that the faithful were being fleeced. In 1913, apostle and trained geologist James E. Talmadge examined a sample from the Dream Mine and declared the ore worthless. The First Presidency issued a statement in the Deseret News titled, A Warning Voice, that, while mentioning neither Coyle nor the Dream Mine, advised all Latter-day Saints against investing, quote, in ventures of any kind on the specious claim of divine revelation or vision or dream, and against mining schemes which have no warrant for success beyond the professed spiritual manifestation of their projectors, and the influence gained over the excited minds of their victims, unquote. 5 days after the publication of the warning, Coyle was released as bishop of the Utah County congregation he had served for more than 5 years. Ironically, Lars Olsen, who succeeded him as bishop, was Coyle's dedicated follower and a laborer at the mine. In 2007, Olsen's descendants still owned stock in the Dream Mine. To the mine's faithful, the Mormon Church's opposition reflected both its fear and envy of Coyle's power. They felt the authorities could sanction no revelation at the grassroots that had the potential to challenge their power or spark heresy. Quote, "Bishop Coyle's prophecies and his dreams began to stir up new commotion and excitement, while faith in the spiritual powers of the church president began to wane. This kind of embarrassment usually causes jealousy and anger," wrote Ogden Kraut. Though church leadership appeared united in public, there was some division in their ranks. J. Golden Kimball was a stockholder, an LDS general authority and a member of the First Council of the 70. Carter E. Grant, nephew of church president Heber J. Grant, also owned stock in Coyle's enterprise. During this same period, motivated by the promise of acceptance into America's religious mainstream, the LDS Church abandoned polygamy and began de-emphasizing Joseph Smith's mystical world of miracles, magic, buried gold, holy messengers, demonic apparitions, visions, and dreams. As the church made this pragmatic shift, dream miners felt marginalized, denied a role in the divine drama. However, as Kraut put it, quote, "This opposition only proved to give new strength to the bishop. It was clear that the Lord was sustaining him and his mission at the mine," unquote. Church opposition and the threat of excommunication led Coyle to cease mining between 1914 and 1920. However, due to a vision Coyle claimed to have received from two of the three Nephites, his followers and investors remained dedicated to the cause. The Nephites offered Coyle startling visions of an economic catastrophe awaiting the nation. A deflated dollar, rampant unemployment, and hunger, all harbingers of the end. During the shutdown, Coyle's believers preached his prophecies of the end times, and when the mine reopened in September 1920, work recommenced immediately. Workers pressed forward on the main shaft, quote, "as fast as miners with hand drills and powder could drive a tunnel into solid mountain rock," unquote. As the excavation encountered the geologic formations that Coyle had reportedly predicted, his prophetic reputation grew. Hundreds of people visited the mine to see firsthand the confirmation of prophecy, and many stayed to work in the mine, content to receive their pay in stock. Soon, the main shaft descended 2,200 feet. A change in focus, the Dream Mine and economic crisis. Coyle awoke one morning in June 1929 and predicted that in precisely 4 months, quote, "Wall Street will crash. Thousands of people on every side will be going busted," unquote. When the market plunged in October, the story quickly spread that Coyle had foretold the catastrophe. Again, people gathered at the Coyle farmstead not far from the mine to hear his predictions of the coming peril. He regularly updated his prophecies with new details from revelations he received while asleep. In 1932, invigorated by the prophecies, Coyle's followers supplied money and labor to build a state-of-the-art mill, sometimes called the White Sentinel, near the mouth of the Dream Mine Tunnel to process Coyle's predicted outpouring of gold. Quote, "The money came in almost miraculously," remembered Pierce, who was at the Dream Mine when laborers began building the mill. With all indications seeming to point to the immediate fulfillment of Coyle's prophecies, stockholders, quote, "scraped the bottom of their depression-worn pockets to raise the money needed to buy the equipment," unquote, "that would refine the ore that would finance the gathering of Israel." This time marked the zenith of the Dream Mine. However, the giant mill never fulfilled the promise. Since becoming operational in 1936, it has processed only one load of ore, netting the company $103.03. 1 year later, the mill shut down, and, as of this printing, it stands on the mountain empty and quiet. But true believers are unshaken. In the words of Ogden Kraut, quote, "When the Lord releases these riches, then the white sentinel will become like an ensign to the nations for a place of relief," unquote. Coyle, who turned 80 in 1944, kept followers' faith alive with a long list of prophecies. Quote, "Hardly a year passed without several new dreams being related, many of which saw rapid fulfillment," remembered Norman Pierce, who spent more and more time with Coyle as he grew older. Some of Coyle's prophecies failed, such as his prediction that Russian soldiers would soon overrun America. But believers drew sustenance from other revelations, such as Coyle's forecast of Japanese surrender in 1945. In 1947, Coyle was brought before a Mormon ecclesiastical court, where he was given a choice: issue a statement denying his revelations of the dream mine, or face excommunication. On the 8th of January of the same year, the church-owned Deseret News reported Coyle's decision under the headline, "John H. Coyle repudiates all claims regarding the dream mine." The news report reproduced a notarized statement bearing Coyle's signature in which the former bishop sustained the LDS president and, quote, "appealed to all my followers to join with me in this repudiation of claims to divine guidance and connection with this mine," unquote. But within days, Coyle had repudiated the statement. He claimed that he had been forced to sign the declaration and swore that all his prophecies were true. Coyle was finally excommunicated on the 15th of April, 1948. He died just over a year later, at age 84. Ogden Kraut eulogized the man he considered a prophet. Quote, "Christ never saw the triumph of his church while he lived. The prophet Joseph Smith never saw the redemption of Zion while he was alive. And Bishop Coyle never realized the materialization of the ore deposited in that mountain. But in the last days, they all shall see the fulfillment of their vision," unquote. If LDS authorities believed that Coyle's death would end the mine dream, they were disappointed. Even though no mining has occurred in decades, the dream endures. Vindication deferred. Modern belief in the dream mine. As Coyle's contemporaries died, they passed their stock to a new generation of believers who could remember the bishop only in his later years, if at all. Today's stockholders know of the dream mine secondhand through the yellowed stock certificates they inherited and the stories swapped among the old-timers of Utah County. Recently, the internet has tightened the community of believers by fostering more frequent communication and interaction. Just as it always has, the dream mine attracts believers as an investment in the magical origins of their Mormon faith, and in a destiny that awaits ultimate fulfillment. In the 6 decades since Coyle's death, his followers have continued to read the signs around them, convinced that prophecy is about to be fulfilled. Though the LDS Church de-emphasized eschatology during the years after Coyle's death, dream mine believers found encouragement in the religious Great Awakening that followed World War II, when Christians, both fundamentalist and evangelical, saw signs that God had re-entered history. The recreation of the State of Israel in 1948, exactly 1 month after Coyle's excommunication, suggested that the eschatological clock had begun to tick again. Quote, "When are the times of the Gentiles, non-Mormons, to be over?" asks one dream mine believer in the online group devoted to Coyle and the mine. Quote, "The scriptures tell us that we can recognize it by the sign that the Jews will begin to gather in Israel. Is it just a coincidence that 1948 brought about Coyle's excommunication at the same time that the Jews began to gather?" Unquote. At the center of the network of true believers is Doc Hansen, currently the Dream Mine's chief promoter. In his mid-50s, Hansen is a devout member of the LDS Church who was raised in Utah County. As a boy, Hansen says, he was fascinated by the Dream Mine, though he knew very little about it. Quote, "I saw the zigzag of the road going up the hill and the big white mill, and it always attracted me," he remembers. As a high school senior, Hansen finally decided to investigate. He found Norman Pierce's book in the public library and convinced of the truthfulness of the narrative and Coyle's calling as a prophet, although it would still be many years before he bought his first shares in the mine. Hansen was converted. Quote, "If you're meant to be connected with a project, the spirit just grabs you and yanks you into the project," he says. Hansen has a bookshelf in his Utah County office holding dozens of titles by evangelical writers about the last days. In the 21st century, devout dream miners connect in cyberspace, exchanging prophecies and opinions via a Yahoo group titled The Dream Mine. We are keeping the dream alive. Hansen founded the e-group on the 10th of December 2001. In its first 7 years, the group attracted close to 1,000 members and received more than 12,900 different posts. Quote, "I had about 20 people join right away, and it kept growing faster," Hansen remembers. "I have people email me privately to say, I was led to this. People have dreams that lead them to this group," unquote. Although the posters to the group are often anonymous, their messages offer insight into the perspectives of current Dream Mine movement members. Many posts scrutinize Coyle's prophecies in the light of current world events, wars, famines, earthquakes, and other disasters. Eager for the end of time, a 2007 poster to the group declared in reference to Coyle's prophecy of a conflict between Russia and Turkey, quote, "Keep an eye on Turkey. Some interesting things are going on over there now. Climate changes, volcanoes, current events. Preparedness is a lot like insurance. You have to have it before it's needed," unquote. Coyle had predicted that war will rage on the coastline of America, and an army of 100,000 Russians will invade North America through Canada. In the Middle East, America's armies will falter. A worldwide famine will send prices skyrocketing for basic staples like rice and wheat. Postings on the Dream Mine e-group tempt believers with the recurring certainty that the end is at hand. Quote, "The mine will open up in the fall season," wrote one poster confidently in October 2001. "Will it be this fall after an economic collapse? Who knows? It's been a long, hot summer," smiley emoji. "Who has a farmer's almanac? What's this winter supposed to be like?" unquote. That post was challenged by another core believer who wrote simply, quote, "The mine can't open yet, not for 2 to 4 years. The parameters don't fit yet," unquote. The Dream Mine prophecies, though paralleling the eschatological scenario of evangelical Christians, bear Coyle's and Mormonism's distinct imprint. Dream Mine believers predict that before the mine reopens, the American dollar will become worthless and the federal government will collapse. The LDS Church will be set in order, an enigmatic phrase about which believers regularly deliberate. An especially difficult winter will afflict Utah County the year the mine comes in, followed by spring flooding and a dry, scorching summer. With the area's weather remarkably consistent with this pattern, dream miners are always ready to predict that the mine is about to come in. As one poster asked in an April 2008 message to the group, quote, "Is this the year? We're very close to the mine becoming active, and I think that Utah will be where the new economy begins, and that the dream mine will help to bring back America from the brink of absolute economic devastation. Thank God I live in Utah and near the mine," unquote. Conclusion: the persistence of belief. Today, housing divisions sprout like wild mushrooms beneath the dream mine, in tracts of land which were farms in John Coyle's day. Newcomers look up at the cone-shaped mountain to the east and wonder about the odd-looking derelict building that sprawls in a cleft of the rocky mountainside. But for dream miners, the building is a beacon of hope. They recall that in the days just before John Coyle died, the old bishop made one final hike up Dream Mountain. On the side of the mine, squinting out over the fields where he had spent most of his life, he experienced a last vision. He saw a, quote, small rift in the dark clouds, revealing a little spot of blue, unquote. The spot expanded, the skies opened, and, quote, the mine and its surroundings were restored to the brilliant sunshine of a fine, glorious day, with all oppressiveness having vanished away, unquote. True believers are certain that this final vision was God's promise to Coyle that his life had not been in vain, an assurance extended to their own lives. They remain, as Coyle's faithful follower Norman Pierce declared, quote, prepared, mentally and spiritually, to be steadfast in watching and waiting for a glorious vindication that they know will come.